We're back for part two of our episode, Fighting on Other Fronts. I'm Hannah Stanley, the host of On Social Health and Change, brought to you by Adler University. With me is Grady Austin Garner, a retired Army Reserve captain and professor in Adler's Doctor of Psychology and Clinical Psychology program. Also joining us is Michael Emil, a doctoral candidate in that program. Thank you guys both so much for coming in and joining me and everyone here who's listening. Grady, as a retired officer, what is your perspective on the change in culture and attitudes in the military surrounding LGBT community and the people who are actually enlisted?
Well, first of all, Hannah, I want to thank you for having us here to talk about these really, really important issues that are happening in the military. The changes that are coming about are really significant in that they are tremendous cultural changes in the military, huge paradigm shifts as it relates to LGBT individuals. I know that later we're going to talk about women in the military, particularly as it relates to sexual assault and so on, but also men, of course, who are victims of such tragedy. So thank you so much for that.
Absolutely.
As the coordinator of the military, the doctoral emphasis in military clinical psychology at Adler, and a retired military officer, I find these issues to be really important to me, both professionally and personally. I'm also a member of the LGBT community in that I am a self-identified gay man. My pronouns are him.
Okay.
And his. And my husband is non-military, but we have experienced as a family some of the challenges of being a gay man or an LGBT individual serving in the military. So really excited about talking about these issues. I first want to sort of preface it with as a former officer in the military, one thing that we do is we look to our commander-in-chief for leadership. And President Obama has done an extraordinary job of sort of moving us forward as it relates to military culture. For one, he's overseen sort of the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And that's a really tremendous step forward with regard to culture and customs and rituals and these sort of things that we practice in the military, but also allowing people to openly serve, you know, as members of the LGBT community. During my time in the military, so I started, oh my gosh, I'm going to date myself here.
That's okay.
I'm really 27, but actually.
It's a 20-year career, yes.
That's right. I joined actually in 1982. Okay. In 1982, there was no Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. One just could not serve as a same-gender loving individual. And during the time, I joined at 17, so I just graduated from high school and, of course, needed, you know, parents' permission and that sort of thing to join. Happy to serve, excited about serving. I got to the part of the application where it asked, are you a homosexual? And at that moment, I wasn't sort of self-identified as gay. In fact, I was fighting my sexuality,
which makes sort of, sense
absolutely.
At 17.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Yeah, wasn't sure. I was dating girls and doing all the things I was supposed to do and that sort of thing. It wasn't until my early to mid 20s that I realized that I am full
this
on.
This is who you are.
This is who I am. Mm-hmm. And that I should do what I can to be that person, to live that life fully. But at the time, that was really disheartening because it was a question that I had in my mind and it almost prevented me from joining. I said, if I can't answer it clearly, then perhaps this is not what I should be doing.
But that indicates that you were going into it with the right ethics and moral code, that you wanted to serve the country,
absolutely.
Our country, but do it honestly.
Absolutely.
So to question it at that point, good for you.
Yeah. And it represented, for me, sort of a sense of one of those moral dilemmas, one of those issues that one has to wrestle with. And so now that that's no longer an issue in the military and that folks can openly serve as LGBT individuals, I am tremendously relieved that current recruits and young people, young men and women who are interested in serving their country in the way that I've had the benefit of doing can do that now. I think it's wonderful. So there's been a lot of sort of developments there, but, you know, some of the other things that you know, the commander-in-chief was responsible for, or really responsible for pressing, were things like lifting the ban of women serving in combat. That is just fantastic. Mm-hmm. And again, another major cultural shift and change in the military. And then, of course, aggressively cracking down on sexual assault and sexual harassment, which is, we'll talk about later, but that has been an ongoing, you know, issue and still long-standing issue in the military. So we've got a lot of room for growth, that's for sure.
And multiple layers with mm-hmm. that as well when mm-hmm. we're dealing with injuries and trauma and separation.
Absolutely.
All kinds of things gather to that. Mm-hmm. Not at all justifying, mm-hmm. but understanding why it could be a little bit more prevalent than mm-hmm. in regular society.
Yeah, yeah. So the idea that people who are most vulnerable and also people who are more likely, perhaps, I think is what I'm picking up here, is this idea that people who are more likely than to commit these kinds of crimes, right, are people who may not be well-adjusted. Mm-hmm. So there is some validity to that, but also there are people who just tend to orient themselves in that direction mm-hmm. For one reason or another, and it's really quite a terrible thing, and we need to continue to make efforts, and I think we are to improve that situation. But yeah, so it's really just wonderful to be in a space where these questions are being debated openly and, you know, publicly, and policies are being changed and altered and modified, you know, to adjust and adapt to the 21st century, you know, and allowing people to be who they are and to serve openly and to address issues of abuse, assault, harassment directly and head on.
Which is an incredibly powerful point. I'm gonna dance around this question for a second because it's gonna form.
Okay.
But what I, living here in a more urban environment, a larger city, I feel like we have made tremendous leaps and bounds mm-hmm. as far as acceptance and understanding and the normalcy, mm-hmm. which I hate the fact that it's normal because it's mm-hmm. not abnormal, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. people going, oh, okay, well, he is married to a man. Mm-hmm. All right, that mm-hmm. is fine. But I wonder when people enroll in the military, especially if they come from this environment where it's not as big of a deal, mm-hmm. when they're exposed and enlisted with people who are from all different cultures, mm-hmm. who would definitely, possibly, mm-hmm. possibly, definitely not be as open-minded, mm-hmm. While the military itself is moving that direction, mm-hmm. what are those growing pains like for those people to go, wait mm-hmm. a second, I have never met a gay man in my life, and mm-hmm. now I'm sleeping next to one?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that is a challenge, right? And that's one of the things I think was a little bit of a concern early on. In fact, the argument was that, you know, it could affect morale, it could affect discipline, it could affect, you know, sort of unit cohesion and all of these things. And it turns out, you know, over the course of many, many years now, that that hasn't sort of borne itself out, you know, right? So there hasn't, what we predicted to be a challenge or an issue for us has turned out not to be. Now, on an individual level, there is this sort of struggle, right? Mm-hmm. And what ultimately, what we're finding is that younger people who join the military do predominantly come from these cultures where there's a mix of expression, support, experience as it relates to LGBT individuals. Mm-hmm. And so when they come together, as long as senior leadership is oriented in a way that they are promoting inclusion and acceptance, not just tolerance, but inclusion and acceptance, it's amazing how quickly the attitudes, the mind, the behavior, all of that shifts. You know, they're mm-hmm. looking around and seeing that other people, including leadership, and, you know, it's a top-down structure in the military.
Big time.
Uh-huh. And so, you know, and as a former commander of 141 officers, or soldiers, rather, 41 of them officers, many of them higher ranking than I, which was really an interesting and challenging career challenge for me, but mm-hmm. but it worked out very, very well. I can appreciate the influence that that a leader has, and for those young minds who are struggling with, again, acceptance or inclusion, they turn to the leaders to determine how they should behave or how they should interact with these other individuals. And what we know from sociology and many psychological theories support this idea as well, that contact, So social contact changes minds and hearts and
right.
and so on.
All right. So mm-hmm. so they might walk in with preconceived notions or no notions, but a little bit of mm-hmm. a feeling of uncomfortableness.
Yes. Yeah.
And then once they realize it's all the same, you were there for the same purpose,
yeah.
to defend each other,
yes. mm-hmm.
to get each other in and out of these conflicts,
mm-hmm.
Then it goes away.
Mm-hmm.
The difference is minimized.
Mm-hmm. And many of them have actually discovered, those who are currently serving, that they've been serving alongside LGBT individuals all along.
I'm sure, some people when you joined.
Absolutely.
And they had no idea.
Absolutely.
Because you didn't necessarily have an idea at that point.
Did not. And when I did, I couldn't share that. So I couldn't ask or tell.
Right. Right? Now you couldn't. You've gone through all different layers of this.
Yeah, absolutely.
So when this, you and I could chat about this for days, but would you say that the military is otherwise where it needs to be, or are we still growing?
I think we're still growing. Yeah, I think we are. I think what's happening is leadership is becoming more on board, which is really wonderful. And again, as long as they continue to sort of share this openness, this inclusion, this respect, and interacting with people who are different than we are, than they are. That's very helpful. It really is. And it's not affecting things like recruitment or retention or any of those things. So all the fears that we had in the past, those are no longer, they're not bearing out. So we are not as concerned about that. So I think it's just a matter of time, sort of increasing awareness and understanding. And again, more of that social contact. And I think we'll begin to move forward or continue to move forward. Yeah.
Now, you've been referring it to it as the LGB community. So
yes.
Now we're going to talk about the T portion of
yes.
that. And Michael joining us as well. When we and boy, that has been a tremendous topic in the news and in social culture mm-hmm. for the past probably year to 2 years. Militarily, when we talk transgender and people who identify as a different gender, how are they included within military culture?
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Certainly.
Let me start off by saying I identify male, so he, his, him pronouns.
Mm-hmm.
I also identify as a gay man myself. And I start off this way because I think it's really important to sort of normalize that process.
Mm-hmm.
So when we talk about transgender issues, specifically within the military, we have to realize that the repeal act of Don't Ask, Don't Tell in 2010 actually did nothing for transgender status within the military. It was a congressional act that was specifically targeting same gender loving individuals. So when we talk about transgender and active duty status in the military, we have to talk about the military medical code. Currently, as it stands, transgender individuals are not allowed to serve active duty, despite the fact that for years we know they have been. But it's not a process yet that we fully explored. The DoD is making efforts. It appears as though with the repeal, that question is coming up very often. What do we do now?
Right.
How do we address the issue? Can we address the issue? Is the military ready to handle this issue? We've just only begun to tackle LGB issues within
right.
the military.
Mm-hmm.
But the trend seems to be moving towards that direction that, yes, it's time we address it.
Now, you said that transgender individuals have been serving, but they have done so in their born body, as identifying as the gender that they were born with,
mm-hmm.
correct?
Correct, as the gender
okay.
they were assigned.
Assigned,
at birth.
Okay.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. So they were born male, and even though they identify female, they would then be serving under their male name and acting as a male.
Correct.
Okay. So this has been something that has been going on. They've been hiding who they are for the most part, especially under Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
Correct.
And then now we have to, now it's better to talk about it. It's easier. Like, now it's okay. Now you can say things, sort of. can they come out and say, I am actually transgender if they are enlisted or officers or serving?
Yes. So that's sort of become a gray area in the past year. And the answer is still, unfortunately, no. There are protocols in place where if pursued properly or under the right domains, commanding officers and officials can discharge active duty soldiers who are serving our country, who are putting their lives at risk in so many different ways, and say that you are unqualified to fulfill your duties as an active duty soldier. That because of your gender expression, because you may identify as trans or even intersex, you cannot serve.
I don't even want to say what are the risks, because what are the reasons thus far that are at least in the forefront?
Absolutely. So like the conversation before, don't ask, don't tell, there are a few reasons, right? So I think Grady mentioned before, unit cohesion, mission effectiveness might be compromised. Additionally, this idea that our national secrets might be easily revealed, right?
These are people who are good at keeping secrets. They have hidden some of this stuff for a very long time.
Right. This idea, though, that if presented with the right opportunities, trans individuals would be much more likely to reveal our national secrets, right? That the mission would, of course, be compromised.
No one can see me shaking my head left. No, this is ridiculous.
I think that's a sentiment that many individuals share, right? And we can see the trend that's never happened, right?
No, we've had people who have given up military secrets. I don't know that any of them were identified as a different gender.
Correct. The other big thing right now, and we seem to be coming across this very, very commonly, is the issue of money. So this idea that trans individuals are going to rush towards the armed services to enlist so that government can pay for sex reassignment surgery, that as a result, we're going to have this enormous influx of trans individuals coming and saying, hey, free surgery, free care.
Okay, but here's the thing. You're putting yourself at least in, I mean, you have to realize that at some point there's a possibility you're putting yourself at risk. Mm-hmm. The military population is what, 1% of our full population? Mm-hmm. It is a volunteer organization. All of the branches are volunteer. So even if we had 1%, If we then say 1%, this is a grouping, that's not a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
And they would go, okay, well, let's weigh possibly risking our life for free surgery. Okay, I don't think that holds a lot of water.
Yeah, I would agree. I don't think it holds a lot of water either. But if we're looking at what the literature is showing, if we're looking at what studies have shown right now in other countries who do allow trans soldiers to serve, we're seeing that the cost is relatively a drop in the bucket.
Right.
In comparison, so the U.S. spends on average $40 billion on healthcare alone for soldiers and veterans. There would be an increase of $5 million if trans soldiers were, because that's the key thing, not
right.
All trans individuals want to have sex reassignment surgery. But if they wanted to, it may be an additional $5 million in actual costs, which, again, is sort of a drop in the bucket when you talk about $40 billion. And healthcare costs.
All right. So me, I think this is ridiculous and very short-sighted. I feel like everyone sitting here in the room is on the same page with me. Are there reasons why we say, no, that's okay, we could see why they wouldn't do that? Or are they all just kind of like, well, we'll get there? Because all of these are sort of wishy-washy arguments.
I think the trend is now we're moving towards inclusion. So Ash Carter, Secretary, has decided this needs to become acknowledged publicly. Our policy needs to shift. So a year ago, he convened panels to undergo the same processes that were for women who wanted to serve active, you know, in combat situations. And the idea is what needs to happen in order for policy to change within the medical community, the mental health community, and in each branch in order for trans individuals to actively and openly serve. And I think right now we're seeing that shift happen, that we're seeing that there will be some logistical changes. So this idea of room assignments, uniform assignments, bathroom assignments, right? So all of these things are logistical concerns that can be addressed, right? Same ways we address the issue when we had women serve, right? I think these are just minor red tape situations that could be rectified through proper inclusion and investigation.
Especially because the uniform just seems weak. I mean, it's the female uniform is not that different, and it's designed to not be that different from the male mm-hmm. uniform. Mm-hmm. All right. So we as a community of people who feel that this should be allowed need to just make that heard to our representatives and whoever would be voting on this.
Absolutely. Anytime we deal with policy, we want to make sure that everyone is behind this, that we have done all we can to make sure the necessary efforts have been put in place so that we can acknowledge and show and demonstrate our inclusion and acceptance of trans and intersex individuals serving in active duty. What's interesting, though, in terms of policy change is the VA recognizes trans veterans. So we're already seeing this shift happen. They are entitled to full benefits, inclusion. They are given full care for both pre and post sex reassignment surgery. Mm-hmm. So if a trans veteran...
So we're already paying for this. Right. They just need to not talk about this while they're serving.
Correct.
And then they're still eligible. People, this is ridiculous.
You know, yeah. It's funny how that works out.
Yeah. Grady and Michael. Thank you. This is another one of those where I'm going to drive home going, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? All right. Anyone listening, thank you so much for your time. And please, if you are as passionate about this or even a quarter as passionate about this as I am, take steps to let people know that and be supportive. Grady and Michael, as I mentioned, from Adler University, thank you so much for your time. This is On Social Health and Change, brought to you by Adler University. I'm Hannah Stanley. Stay tuned for part three when we are going to talk about military sexual assault. And man, that is a topic that needs more attention. Hannah Stanley, thanks for listening.